You may know Michelle Tyreen Johnson as the author of a column that ran in the Kansas City Star from 2008 to 2016. But today, she's here to talk about her irreverent grandma, who she describes, according to Golden Girls lore, as more Sophia than Rose. In other words, wise yet crass. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm pleased to welcome Michelle Tyreen Johnson, who's bottled up her grandmother's wit in a book called Cliffy Notes: Lessons from a Badass Grandma. Hi, Michelle.
Hey, Gina.
What inspired you to write this book?
Well, my grandmother passed away last November, but anyone who's known me has heard my, is what I call them, Cliffy stories from since they've known me, to the point where if I bump into someone that I haven't spoken to in 20 years, one of the first things they would ask me about was my grandmother, because she just had a way about her if you met her, and a way about her if you only heard about her through me.
Well, you know, Cliffy is not just something that you called her. That is actually her name.
That is actually her name.
And that caused puzzlement for people.
Yeah. They didn't quite know what to do with Cliffy. They were like, well, what's it short for? It's like, it's not short for anything. And, well, who was she named after? Well, her aunt. Well, what was her aunt's name? Cliffy. That's kind of the point of naming somebody after someone else. So, yeah, and it was, I don't know, people just, it just fit her. I mean, she's 4'11 and full of personality, and it was just, I don't know, an odd, quirky name that was her actual name.
So one of the biggest challenges you wrote about in writing this book was figuring out which stories and lessons to share, but you add that a subsidiary dilemma was figuring out how much to clean up her language.
Right.
So we can't talk about that using all of the words that you normally might, but talk to me about her way with words and where profanity fit in there.
Well, she was someone who was very direct. I mean, gee, I don't know if I inherited any of that. Anybody who knows me is going to be laughing at that. But she was direct, and there was just nothing that she could say that couldn't be accentuated or punctuated by the use of a word that involves bowel movement. And, you know, there was just a way she had of saying it where it didn't even sound like a cuss word. I mean, growing up, you know, I was like, I mean, I didn't say it as a kid because she was real clear. Children don't speak that way, but Lord knows it's peppered many a conversation I've had since.
What do you think? I mean, I think there's an impulse, especially when you're talking about an older person, to with someone either really old or really young, somehow swearing is funnier.
So true. Exactly. It is.
But
she's always been that.
Do you think there was something more substantive about her use of those words that says something about her, separate from just...
Well, one of the points for me of the book in writing, and it's a short book, but is just her sayings and her commentary on things were getting to the heart of something. So she was not someone who cussed just to be cussing. As I said, it was sometimes when she said a certain word, it was a statement in and of itself. So, you know, I can't believe so-and-so did such and such. Bleep. You know, that punctuates what she just said. So it wasn't as if she was using it as an adjective for just having it routinely come out of her mouth. That's the way some people cuss. It's like everything is a blanking this or a blanking that. She didn't cuss that way. It was more of a way of just, I don't know.
Pay attention.
Right.
I just said something important.
Yeah. And, you know, she was just not hung up on the formalities that everybody else gets hung up on, which is the thing I most admired about her. And yet at the heart of everything she said, it was just being truthful. So, you know, getting hung up on how somebody says something sometimes obscures what do they say.
So along those lines, is there a story that you wrote about her that as you were writing it, it brought up emotions that you weren't expecting?
Well, you know, the whole book probably was that. It was a labor of love, because I said she just passed away in November. And even though it was a long illness, she had Alzheimer's. I think part of writing the book was not so much to keep her alive in that corny sort of way, but just she said so many wise and funny things, and usually wise and funny went together with her, that I didn't want to lose it, and I wanted to spread it out to people, and that's been one of the biggest joys of this, is to have people unexpectedly, since it came out last month, to send me a message and go, oh my God, I wish I had met your grandmother.
Okay, I'm going to take us through some of the lessons that, that she teaches through you in this book, starting with lessons on love and romance. And just thinking back on the conversation we just had about language, I'm not actually going to say the name of the chapter about her warnings regarding men and passion.
I knew that one.
Not on the radio at 10 a.m., but she says in her own way that a man in a certain state cannot entirely be trusted.
Right. And I mean, it's something that everybody probably knows, whether they would phrase it that way, which is that the best and most wonderful and loving and honest man, if he's trying to get something from you, especially at the moment he's trying to get something from you, he might not be the most honest, truthful person. So don't make life decisions based on what someone says to you at a passionate time.
Well, so, I mean, it's funny, but like, you write this whole chapter around this that actually gets into some pretty deep territory.
That's what I try to do. I mean,
can you take us there now?
It's just her. It wasn't about being an anti-man chapter at all. It was just an observation of how men actually are. Not all men, of course, but because her point was making the distinction between a bad man who lies all the time, regardless of the situation, and a man who is being just, he's not thinking at his best in certain moments.
What did you take from that, though, as a woman in, you know, the 21st century, living in a very different era than when a lot of your grandmother's experiences were coming from, you know, someone who's been a lawyer, someone who's been a journalist? I mean,
what I took from most of what Cliffy said, which is why so much of what she said is true, is that the heart of it is true regardless of whether you're born in 1928 or whether you're born in 1964 or whether you're born in 1995, is if the point, like, for example, the example we just talked about, if the point is that you as a woman have to think about your needs and wants and not rely on somebody in what they say, that applies no matter who you are or what you do. I mean, it's about taking care of yourself. Her point wasn't don't, as a woman, you know, do whatever with a man. Just don't rely on what men say when they're in pursuit mode to make your decisions, whether it's a decision of the moment or a decision that can land you a lifetime problem.
Was it important to you at any point that she had told you this? How old were you when she told you this?
Oh, God, probably pretty young. I mean, again, my grandmother didn't make my mother's very similar, too. I mean, they understand that the time to have these conversations are before you need to have the conversations, not as you're having an issue, as you're having a problem. And that's probably one of the reasons I've passed it on to so many friends over the years. She has another chapter where she talks about, again, I have to clean up the language, but the degree to which you put a man in charge of something that isn't his idea is the degree to which he will mess it up. And her point isn't...
That is a chapter where the title of it is, we can't
right,
know.
Exactly. But her point is, you know, I use the example, a man who builds bridges for a living can be the best bridge builder in the world. He has built bridges that, you know, billions of traffic can drive across. But if his wife or his girlfriend ask him to pick takeout on the way home and it's not his idea, then, you know, you may or may not have takeout that night.
Well, so a lot of people might hear this and be like, man, this is a lot of generalizing about men. What about?
She had plenty to say about everybody. Men, women, all races, all ages. The two, I think, more colorful examples involve men. But, you know, another chapter I talk about is I get into the issue of gentrification. You know, the title is White Folks Shall Pay a Lot for Greens, because her point was...
Well, wait, tell me the story of when she said that.
Well, one day we were out running errands, and as I say in the book, all errands either began or ended usually with, as an adult, all errands began or ended with us taking a trip to the boat, because her, like, favorite pastime was slot machines. She loved slot machines. It's like, bringing slot machines to Kansas City was like, wow, how fun is that? And one day when we were out running errands, we went into a Super Target. And, you know, the kind that has everything you can buy, like, right there on the spot, including groceries. And she'd never been in one of those before. And it was in a part of town where everything is a little bit more expensive than Wyandotte County, where we live. And she said loudly when she went to the produce section, she saw some greens. I can't remember if they were collards or turnips. She goes, "White folks shall pay a lot for greens." And I just busted out laughing because I was like, will you be quiet? Okay, because that's who pretty much everybody in the story is. But her point was, which I talked about in the book, that, you know, from a cultural standpoint, people can put a really big price on something that seems exotic to them, when to you, I mean, it's something that she could either pick for free out at a friend's garden, or she could buy cheaply where she lived, even though we're in the same city, but completely different parts of town. And so it was an interesting, you know, sort of thought process for me as I thought about it over the years, about how cultural appropriation, cultural appreciation, all those things kind of roll together.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'll be getting right back to Cliffy Notes with Michelle Tyrene Johnson. It's stories about her grandmother. We'll be doing that in just a minute. Stay with us. We're back. Michelle Tyrene Johnson, welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard.
Hello.
We are talking about your grandmother, whose name was Cliffy, who died recently, and I'm very sorry about
that. Thank you.
But she's inspired this collection of wit and witticism. I feel like this is a good time to say that it's not all light banter in this book. There's a quote that I'd like to read, which is something
sure.
You write. "One of the big fallacies in how we look at older people is to assume that all older white people are dyed-in-the-wool racists, and that older people of color are all put upon forgiving, gracious, spiritual, even-tempered people and don't harbor any untoward thoughts about others." Can you talk about that observation?
Well, excuse me. I mean, we just... This our way of looking at things in this country, I think, and in some ways, even though I'm a big social media person, I think social media, for all of its advantages, has made it worse, is that we've become very binary in our thinking. Very, this is this, so that must be that. And, you know, if you read Cliffy Notes, then you will see, I mean, Cliffy had several observations about different groups of people, not negative, but things that would make people uncomfortable, because for some reason we bought into some mentality that people of color don't notice color. Only older white people notice color. And that's just not true. I mean, one of the examples in the book is, I still laugh when I think about it, how we went to a Walmart in another part of town.
Again, this is exactly the story I was wanting you to tell. This is a very uncomfortable story.
Right, right. But it's uncomfortable and funny. And at the same time, yeah, it's uncomfortable. But, you know, there's a store in a part of town, a Walmart, that is in a highly Latino patronized area. And on one of our errand days, i.e. going to the boat, I can't remember if it was before or after, I had to run into the Walmart to get something real quick. She stayed in the car, and when I came back out, she was just like flabbergasted because she had just had no idea that so many Hispanics had moved into an area that was 10 minutes from her house. Because of her generation, she pretty much only knew black and white. I mean, she might have had the occasional friend who was something other than black or white or biracial, but that was, and so it wasn't negative, but it was like, you know, she was like, they're everywhere. Where? When did this happen? And that is an observation that people don't associate with people of color seeing that. They think that only white people are going, older white people are going, oh my God, what's happened to our neighborhood? What's happened to our country? But everybody notices when somebody different comes in.
How did you handle that moment? Was it...
You mean after I stopped laughing?
Right.
Because I doubled over laughing because she was saying it was such... I mean, it genuinely was not negative. It was just like she was in awe of this change that she was unaware of. And I probably just said, I mean, the neighborhood's changed. I mean, I don't think it was anything all that deep because, again, it wasn't negative for her. It was just an observation of the changing demographics that it wasn't like we traveled halfway across the country. We were a 10-minute drive from her house.
You know, what you've said about the sort of stereotypes of older people in this country, that an older white person, that there might be a knee-jerk assumption that this is, as you put it, a dyed-in-the-wool racist,
right,
or that a person of color who is older, you make this reference to the word spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wonder if part of what you're doing in telling your grandmother's story is just painting a different picture.
Right. And there's different ways to be spiritual. I mean, you can be, I mean, to me, it's spiritual to be honest. Honesty is spiritual to me, in my definition of spiritual. I mean, it's calling a thing, and not sugarcoating what it is or how it is. And that was my grandmother. I mean, one of the best things about my grandmother, which is something that makes me sad that I wish that every single person who I personally know today knew my grandmother when she was at her healthiest and alive and at her healthiest, because one of her magic tricks, so to speak, was allowing everybody to feel completely themselves in her presence. I don't think that there was anybody that didn't sort of automatically just feel accepted for who they were in her presence.
How do you think she did that?
For one thing, I think she just saw people. And I always have said about her, I could bring anybody, and probably at some point did bring any different kind of person to the house. And she might say something that, again, was politically incorrect. Like, she might ask a question that she shouldn't need to ask. But nobody, I don't think I ever knew anybody who was ever offended by anything, because it was with a genuine inquiry.
Our goodwill,
and it didn't take much to just, you know, say, Cliffy, don't do that's not, you know, oh, okay, I'm sorry. I mean, which again, people always saw that resonated with people, that they didn't have to hide who they were or feel uncomfortable with who they were in her presence.
You mentioned earlier that she had Alzheimer's toward mm-hmm. the end of her life. Can you talk to us a little bit about that experience, really, for you?
Oh, man. Yeah, it was tough. It was tough, and it was long. It was a long, long bout with it. I always say to folks that Cliffy had breast cancer at one point, and she beat it. And she had colon cancer at another point, and she beat it. But Alzheimer's is something that snuck up from behind and got her. And she was a tough old bird, and she is, I feel like she held on as long as she could to try to know and remember who myself and who my mother were. And it was tough for me because I missed the Cliffy that I've always known. I mean, I still miss you know, taking her to the boat, going to her house, talking about stupid stuff, talking about important stuff. I mean, she was my go-to person when I had any question about cooking or any household thing. And, you know, I mean, over the years, you lose that habit of doing it. But yeah, she's pretty awesome.
You know, she had also had polio as a child.
Yeah, she was born and one of her legs was a little bit shorter. So she at one point had special shoes designed. Then as she got older, she walked with two canes. She didn't like walkers, which is funny to see her at the boat, because if there was one time, any other time she went to get out of something, oh, I can't walk very well. You know, I have these two canes. Would you like to go to the boat? Would you like to go to... I won't advertise which her favorite boat was. Oh, okay. And she'd move like the wind. she could be in a marathon.
But with the two canes.
With the two canes. She was booking.
One of the scenes that you write about at the boat is at the all-you-can-eat buffet. And your two differing interpretations of what all-you-can-eat means.
Yes, yes. Yeah, she was the only... sort of dishonest thing about Cliffy was that she didn't have any problem with putting some food at a buffet in her pocket, because in her mind it said all you can eat, and if I can't eat it all here, I can eat some later. And we had this back and forth joke. I'm like, but it's all you can eat here. She would always go with this look of utter seriousness, but it doesn't say that.
There was one time when you decided that she was right, that...
Well, we had gone to a boat one day and went to the buffet afterwards. And unbeknownst to me, she had snuck some ham in her pocket to take home. And I realized this the next day when I woke up, because it was the year after I had moved home for about a year after law school and I lived with her. And she didn't have a car. So if it was in the house, either I bought it or I was with her when she bought it. And I knew there was no ham in the house. But I woke up to the smell of ham and I instantly realized what she had done. And so when I was about to chastise her for it, she goes, look, here's a plate of food. You want it? So I just ate that ham and shut up, because it wasn't like I could take the ham back.
So for you, though, I mean, you are a person who has achieved a lot of things in your own life, and you have gained a lot of recognition within your own community as a writer and as someone with a lot to share about diversity and the workplace and beyond. Mm-hmm. Did she shape any of that? Do you recognize, as you're writing about her and these stories, which all are sort of, they're funny and personal, but do they speak to these larger things?
Well, you know, again, I think that just being someone not afraid to observe the differences in people probably came from how I was raised. I've always had to sort of navigate different environments. And, you know, what my grandmother and the rest of my family too, my grandfather, my mother, my great grandmother, all of my family, you have to have a sense of self no matter what environment you're in. And I think Cliffy was particularly gifted at that. And I think that's is what was the carryover for me when I was a journalist and then when I was an attorney. And now that I work at a school and I'm a writer and a playwright, that sense of myself is going to be myself no matter what environment I'm in. So, you know, it's not that I'm going to change to meet you. I'm just going to be cognizant of who I am in these varied environments. And I think that's very much a Cliffy thing.
She did not want to be called Black.
Yeah, she was of that generation. A lot of Black folks were in that generation where Black was perceived as a negative, because she came from an era of colorism, heightened colorism. So, you know, she'd prefer colored, because I guess for her generation, it's something we can't really relate to right now. That seemed better to her than being called Black. So, for what that's worth.
Michelle Tyreen Johnson, author of Cliffy Notes, Lessons from a Badass Grandma. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we'll talk to the great niece of Dolores Huerta, a civil rights activist. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're going to hear about a woman by the name of Dolores Huerta. She founded the Farm Workers Union alongside Cesar Chavez. She fought and still fights at 87 for racial justice and women's rights.
Dolores is an icon.
She's a civil rights hero.
She's the first general that I followed into war.
She's not afraid to speak truth to power.
Dolores Huerta, who is an old friend of mine.
The FBI knew how dangerous Dolores was. Dolores came up with the slogan, Si se puede.
Yes, we can.
But she's been written out of a lot of that history.
People in power have no idea of the true heroes of this country.
I would not have been able to see what's hidden in the fields of our country without Dolores.
We're knee-deep in sexism when it comes to why she isn't studied and why people don't know her.
A new documentary with lots of star power, which we were just hearing clips from, is trying to change that. Dolores the movie hits theaters this month, but for now, we're going to have a preview with Dolores Huerta's great-niece who lives in Kansas City, Jackie Fernandez-Lanati. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So let's just pretend that you are at a party and you're talking to someone and it comes up that you're related to Dolores Huerta and someone's like, who's that? What do you tell them?
Well, first and foremost, I say she's my great-aunt. And she is a civil rights icon. I quickly say that she is the longest serving civil rights icon in this country. And at the age of 87, she will dance you under the table.
So you guys go dancing a lot?
Oh, yeah. Well, every family function, wedding, reunion, everything, we always have dances. And she is the last one on the dance floor.
So could you give us a slightly longer recap of her career as an activist?
Sure. Well, you know, she would say that she became an activist at the age of 8 when she joined the Girl Scouts. And it went from there. And when she became a teenager and then went into college to study for teaching, she also became at the same time involved with the community service organization with Fred Ross Sr. And that's where she really that's where she met Cesar Chavez. And that's where she really got in tune with the power an individual has to make a difference. And she will say all that. And she says that in the film. And then when she went into the classroom as a teacher and migrant farm children would come into her classroom without shoes and she would make home visits and realize that they were living in tents on the side of the fields or in cars. And she realized that her power as an individual would be better served elsewhere outside of the classroom.
And what I've seen of the movie, she has this very calm, direct, unrattled presence. She just seems very calm. That's not necessarily how people think of activists.
No, and you know, she's pretty feisty. She's a tiny little thing. I'm not sure she's 5 foot tall. If so, she's barely. And, you know, all of what, 85 pounds wet. And, and boy, you know, try to have a conversation with her in which you challenge a fundamental belief of hers.
And have you done that?
Oh, well, you know, I was raised in the family. And so, you know, I would say I'm in alignment with much of what she is fighting with. But I will tell you that when I came of age, of voting age, I decided to register independent. And that was my sort of, you know, rebellion, and I'm going to be my own person. And oh, yeah, that became a big issue in the family that I had not registered as a Democrat voter. And so, you know, she can hold her own. And I think that goes without saying, given the fact that she was coming of age as an activist in a time when feminism was barely being born. And so she was having to hold her own, not only in the Mexican culture, in the face of machismo, but she was having to hold her own in, you know, the greater United States culture of, you know, sexism.
Can you flesh out a little bit what you were just saying there? I mean, is there an example that you'd like to point to of a time when she was backed into that corner you just described as an activist, both within the broader culture of the United States and within the Latino culture?
Well, I think the fact that she's now 87 years old, and this is the first time that we're seeing a documentary produced about her. When I was going through school in the 80s, as a young person, I learned about Cesar Chavez a little bit. My children learned about Cesar Chavez more, but they also learned about Dolores Huerta. So she has been, you know, in service for decades and has been in the shadow of Cesar Chavez. You know, she coined the phrase, si se puede, and that has only recently come out. You know, it was credited to Cesar for many, many years.
Tell us the story of that, the invention of that phrase.
Yeah, so she was, you know, organizing at this time in Arizona, and there were conversations there, and the people in Arizona were saying, you can't do it here, no se puede, you can't do that here, what you're doing in California, that is not going to work here in Arizona, and no se puede, and she responded, si se puede, we can do that, yes we can, which is a familiar phrase, right, because that was adopted then by candidate Barack Obama, presidential candidate, and so for that became the United Farm Workers slogan, and si se puede, and you know, I can't remember a time in my life when I didn't know that phrase. It was 1972 when she coined that. I was born in 74. And so then fast forward to Barack Obama's presidential campaign, and he goes with the slogan, yes, we can, you know, and it was kind of a thing in our family. But hey, that's ours, you know. And but in 2012, he awarded her with the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And he confessed during that presentation that he stole it. And, you know, and it was a beautiful exchange. You can see the video where she, you know, she kind of giggles and raises an eyebrow at him like, mm-hmm. And but he was like, yeah. And, you know, and, I'm gracious to say, you know, that I can get away with it.
What was it like to grow up with her in your life? You talked about coming, being part of this family, and that, and being part of this family means that registering to vote as anything but a Democrat is like sacrilegious.
Absolutely.
But what else did it mean?
Well, because everything you do as a citizen matters. And that it was clear from, like I said, from before I can really, before I could really formulate language, that was driven into me and my cousins. And, you know, we were, it was not uncommon for us to be at a rally or at a march. We were
in the 80s?
In the 80s, yeah, in the 70s. You know, so in strollers. And, you know, Dolores will say,
so this is before they called protesting the new brunch.
Yes, that was before that. And, you know, and she would say, take your children, you know, participate, bring your kids into action and into service. And so that you're cultivating the awareness in our communities of what it means to be an active citizen.
What do you remember about those marches?
Lots of people and lots of yelling, you know, and for me, it was a good time. I grew up in Washington State, but I would spend my summers in California in Stockton, which is where Dolores is from. And my grandfather, she's my grandfather's sister. And then the United Farm Workers Union was headquartered in Delano, and so we would travel down, and sometimes, and there would also be lots of marches, plenty in Sacramento, the state capital. And so I just remember the energy of it and the community sense of it. You know, I had a huge family, but I could tell that this was bigger than my family. This was a bigger presence and a bigger experience than just us.
The documentary about her really makes the case that she was not casually just forgotten by accident, but that she was sort of deliberately omitted from the story that she had such a huge part in. Were you surprised seeing the documentary to hear that argument, or was that something that she had always felt and talked about?
You know, that's something that has been discussed. You know, there are a lot of there are a lot of conversations that we've had, you know, in the family about this person, Dolores, because she's our family member and she's also this public figure. But to hear it said in no uncertain terms was really validating.
What was it, surprising at all, or just validating of something that you always felt was true?
It was validating. It was just validating. It was not surprising at all. And it may be, you know, for the larger, you know, for the country, it may have been surprising, but I think in California, it was probably not surprising.
It is interesting, you know, you see people like John F. Kennedy saying her name and introducing her as his friend, and then you realize that this is a name that I didn't hear in school growing up, and I'm curious for you if you have a sense of why she would have been written deliberately out of a story.
Well, you know, I think it, and they say it right there, and you played the clip, you know, we're knee deep in sexism when we really face the fact that here we have this woman who has accomplished so much in this country and has gone unnoticed, virtually unnoticed. And, you know, for me, it's, she's always been in my awareness. And so I've sort of made it my own little personal, you know, when you asked me at the beginning of the interview, like, let's say you're at a party and it comes up, well, it tends to come up. And, you know, and it's not just about pride in that, but it's about, you know, communication and connection and letting people know what's happening in the world and the service that people are taking to heart.
There's some really difficult stuff about that she had to leave behind some of her children as part of what she felt was her calling to stand up for migrant farm workers.
Yes. And that was really interesting to me to see that on the big screen, you know, because I felt like it was a very honest depiction. It wasn't shaming, which often women are shamed for leaving the home and being active in society, whether it's, you know, in profession or, you know, in politics or community service like that.
And she had 11 children.
Yeah, she had 11 children. And so it's also true, and I wish they had shown this, but, you know, I've also heard stories about where she would get up on a podium to give a speech and down on the bottom of the platform underneath the table was a bassinet with a baby in it, you know? So her kids were traveling with her at times. And then yeah, there were large chunks of times, you know, and they talk about when she went to New York where the kids did not go. And so there's been this, you know, there was a pain, a real pain. And I think the movie did a really good job of expressing and honoring that pain and that sacrifice. And I'll tell you that when I saw the film screened at the Free State Film Festival in Lawrence earlier this summer, at the end, we stood up and the person sitting next to me turned to me and it was a young man and he said, "Thank you for your family sacrifice. My parents were migrant farm workers and this was everything and very personal to me." So there was also this knowing that there was a sacrifice being made, but for a very deep and important purpose.
I think people generally do know that activists make sacrifices, but so we don't always think about, like, when this guy is thanking you for your sacrifice as the relative of Dolores Huerta, we don't always think about that relatives and families of activists make sacrifices that they didn't necessarily choose. And I'm curious whether you think that that is the same kind of sacrifice when a man makes it as when a woman makes it, and maybe it's something that's just noticed a little more when it's a woman.
Sure. I think it's, that's a really good question. I think it's noticed perhaps differently and maybe categorized differently and judged differently where, you know, with a man who has a public face, you know, there's just an assumption made, well, of course, because who else would be, you know, the face of our, you know, state capitol or White House, right? But when it's a woman, it's still new and different, and so people immediately think about what's the woman's place, where should she be, and so then it calls into question our assumptions about that.
Has it been hard on your family to have people talking about your great aunt, about in the sense of part of what people found problematic about her was that she often had to leave family behind to do what she was doing?
Oh, sure. You know, and family is so important in the Mexican-American culture, and not that more so or, you know, less than other cultures, but it is so fundamentally important in the Mexican-American culture. And so, you know, yeah, it was an issue and it was a topic and it was much discussed, you know, but also the fact of what she was fighting for, you know, she was bringing to light, she was shining light on the shadows of the California farm fields and fighting for a marginalized population. So that was as controversial as anything else. You know, you in the hub of it, of agribusiness in California, if you wore a shirt that was Boycott Grapes or Si Se Puede or Viva Dolores Huerta, you know, you would hear comments about it. I remember walking with my mom and her being told point blank, "You'll get shot around here for wearing that shirt."
Can you remind listeners, especially here we are in the Midwest, you grew up in partially in California. Yeah, where a lot of this issue might have been discussed at greater length. Can you recap sort of why this was so tense?
Well, because the farm workers were not, you know, it was part of the labor movement, the labor rights movement. They were not being treated well. They were not being paid well. They were being crop dusted, literally. They were giving birth to children who had enormous birth defects. There were cancer cells where communities of people would be, you know, getting cancer because of the way of the chemicals that were being used. And people were being forced to work in just horrible conditions. So what she did was she went to the grassroots level and organized the farm workers, empowered them to ask for better working conditions. And where do you make the big difference is in the pocketbooks of the business. And so they organized strikes. And the biggest, probably most notable one would be the table grapes boycott. And that's really the first one that got the attention of the growers and brought them to the negotiating tables.
And she was not beating around the bush with the slogan she used, other, I mean, not just si se puede, but also with a bullhorn yelling like abajo racism, like down with racism. Yes. That seems, you mentioned being, that she was feisty. At like right now, the idea of saying down with racism seems very like in the current of how people talk right now. Did it?
Yeah. Yeah. Think about that for a minute. So she was growing up in the 40s, and she has a story. When she was in high school, she aced a chemistry exam, and her teacher said, no, there's no possible way you cheated, and made her take it again. She aced it again. Okay, so fast forward 50 years, early 90s, I'm in high school in Washington State, and Eastern Washington has a large agribusiness. And so there are a lot of migrant farm workers there. So a lot of Mexican Americans there and Mexicans. And I had an experience where I was a very good student and I was attempting to graduate a year early. And so I went into my guidance counselor and said, you know, I have this plan to graduate early and here's how I'm going to do it. And he looked at me, he pushed the papers aside that I'd brought in. And he said, well, you're just going to end up married and pregnant. Why are you even, why would you even bother to go to college?
What year was this?
This was 1990.
No, no, okay, that's
so
crazy.
So fast forward from her experience in the 40s to mine in the 90s. And, you know, it was that moment that I realized he didn't see a person, a young student, a good student in front of him. What he saw was Fernandez. What he saw was my last name and then all of the assumptions he brought with that. And, you know, my response was, you know, do you know who I am? You know, I didn't say that, but I'm like, it, not only because in my family, I had been groomed, you know, for education is like, you go to, you finish high school, you go to college and, you know, then the rest of it happens. And, but also Dolores Huerta is my aunt, you know, so we, you know, it's like my whole family, my, and it was like the calling, the rise of my ancestors of against this, just experience of racism, this diminutive look at an entire people. And so now fast forward to where, you know, another 20 years. And yeah.
Do you talk to Dolores Huerta about what's going on in our country
yes.
today?
Yes, I do. The last time I saw her in person was last August. My cousin Matthew got married, and so we went to Stockton, and I officiated. I'm a minister. And so it was during the campaign. The presidential campaign. And she took off her Hillary button and put it on me. So I still have it. And I remember feeling like really encouraged by that visit to California and talking with her and my cousins, because in California, you know, blue state, there was a lot of confidence in which way the election would go, where I had been in the Midwest, where there was a lot of confidence in the other direction. And so, you know, we talked then and I came back sort of re-energized, and then the election happened. And, you know, it kind of took the wind out of a lot of sails. You know, she worked very hard. You know, the first time Hillary was nominated, Dolores is the one who introduced her at the convention in Denver. And so, you know, she has been working, you know, in every campaign, and she's there at the presidential inaugurations. It's very personal to her and to the family. But before they screened the film in Lawrence earlier this summer, I called her and because they asked me to introduce the film. And so I was like, Thea, what do you want me to say? Give me a message for the people. They want to hear from you. And what she said was, tell them, do not despair. Do not despair. And remind them of the words of Pablo Neruda, the poet, that you can cut the flowers, but you cannot stop the spring from coming. And we are the spring. And that was her. You know, she doesn't quit. She's 87. And when I called her, she was just getting off a plane, you know, going around following her film everywhere. She doesn't quit. And she doesn't lose hope. And that's what keeps her going, is that it's anything that happens that goes against and that seems to be rolling back the work that she was there and doing in the 60s. You know, she was standing next to Robert Kennedy moments before he was shot. And he was talking about how important the work that she was doing is. To see that now, much of it seemingly getting rolled back, she characterizes that as a call to action that shows us where we need to work harder.
This documentary is a really big deal. As we've already mentioned, I mean, there are clips of JFK introducing his friend, Dolores Huerta. You see Hillary Clinton talking about the importance of Dolores Huerta as a feminist icon. And the idea to make this movie came from Carlos Santana.
Oh, yeah. He's a longtime family friend. You know, Carlos is a very spiritual person. His wife attends Unity of Marin, which I'm a Unity minister. And, you know, and it goes hand in hand. You know, Dolores really comes at this. It's deeper than just politics. It's deeper than just equality. It's rooted really at a fundamental experience of humanity. And so, yeah, Carlos has been a longtime supporter. You know, at her 70th birthday, we had it at the he had a concert for her in Los Angeles, and he's around at a lot of her events. And Peter Bratt and Benjamin Bratt both are also big supporters, and so they were also producers.
What is there a moment in the movie that you found moving and where you learned maybe something you didn't know or hadn't seen in the light that it was being presented?
Well, what was really cool for me was all the footage of when she was younger. And there was even footage that they showed in there that she hadn't seen. So that was cool. And to really see, you know, to see the faces of my cousins, you know, her children in her, and to see just where she started really firsthand. And but I tell you, it was the quote that Angela Davis said at the end. And it was that she was the dancer on the stage of justice. And I thought, how poetic. And which really brought me back to, I'm so glad that she's alive to see this and to experience that and to be honored for her lifelong work in this way, in such a profound and poetic way. Because that's true. My Auntie Dolores is a dancer, and a dancer on the stage of justice. And she would have it that we all join her in that dance.
The dancing part, I mean, you started out this conversation talking about dancing, that she'll dance you under the table.
Absolutely.
Just on a personal note, what is it like to hang out with her?
It's awesome. She's a great fun. You know, again, she doesn't quit. And so you got to be prepared. You know, get some rest before you hang out with Dolores. You know, she's been in Kansas City, you know, a handful of times since I've lived here. And the last time she was here, you know, she visits. She loves Kansas City. She's all over the city. And UMKC hosted her and Gloria Steinem. So we were at a luncheon. And we were sitting at the table, and the the Wild Women of Kansas City were providing the music, and they started singing I Will Survive. And I just knew it. And I looked over at her, and she looked at me, and we stood up and we started dancing. And these two icons, Gloria Steinem and Dolores Huerta, are booty bumping on the dance floor at this luncheon, you know, this banquet.
To I Will Survive.
I Will Survive, you know. And it's like, that's where it's at. Because I tell you what are we fighting for if it's not to live, to dance, to love, to be in the joy of life?
Do you carry that idea with you? I mean, you mentioned being a minister.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's, you know, the same thing. She's shining the light on the marginalized people. And whether it's migrant farm workers, she's, you know, now the Dolores Huerta Foundation, they go into communities and organize people at a grassroots level, ordinary people, to run for office, to run for the school board, to participate and be active community people. And, you know, this is really the core of her life work. That is the inspiration that she is. And that's who she is to me and has always been.
Well, our time is up. But Jackie Fernandez-Lanati, thank you so much for talking to us about your great aunt, Dolores Huerta.
Thank you for having me.
Dolores the Movie is coming out this month, and you can listen back to both of our conversations from today's show at kcur.org/Central Standard. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. We have all of our past shows there as well if you're feeling like some extra listening. Tomorrow, we will get inside information on recipes for the best tacos in KCK, and you will not want to miss that. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Danielle Hogarty. We are on Twitter. If you feel like talking to us between now and tomorrow, you can do that anytime. We're at KCUR CST. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.